Evangelicalism is an aspirational movement. Its central prerogative has been the extension of the kingdom of God by the preaching of a salvation offered by the grace of Christ, as described in the words of the New Testament. And this energizing goal has been a great force for united activity since the inception of the evangelical movement in the 18th century. Ecumenical activity, worship, and fellowship have indeed been understood by evangelicals to both stimulate and prefigure the ultimate goal of evangelical activity, namely the eternal existence of the church in perfect unity with God and with each other. And yet the emphases and temperaments of evangelicalism have been diffused across multiple institutions rather than concentrated in one place. Evangelicalism is therefore not a single church or confession. Rather, it's a shared bundle of words, ideas, beliefs, concepts, descriptions of spiritual reality, organizations and communities that both have family resemblances and family feuds. This means diversity, with the possibility of divergence and even polarization, although I'm going to prefer the term divergence than polarization in this paper, is in the blood of evangelicalism. There never was a pure evangelical movement from which all subsequent divisions are the decadent form. Rather, if we go forward two slides for this one more, as Mark Smith has argued, evangelical identity is always encountered as a hybrid with other sources of identity. You will never meet a mere evangelical. In fact, as we shall see later in this paper, the success of evangelicalism in the 18th, 19th, 20th century has often actually been gone hand in hand with its diversification and with its divergence. We'll see some of the reasons for that. So the commission I was given for this opening paper about evangelical ecumenicity is to provide some kind of historical context and framework for the polarization of Scottish evangelicalism. And history can teach us two things about divergences which we may sense exist within contemporary evangelicalism, contemporary Scottish evangelicalism. First, it can indeed illuminate the origins of the fault lines that we might sense exist within the movement: charismatic and conservative, emergent and traditionalist, socially alert and separatist. We might all have our own particular take on those fault lines. When and where did these labels and the ideas they represent start to have purchase and power within the movement? I'll move on to that kind of question in the second half of the paper. But the second thing history can help clarify and perhaps even problematize is the very syntax, the grammar of the question that we're asking. To ask why are Scottish evangelicals divided requires not only tracking the different twists and turns of the movement over time and seeking the origins of some divisions, but also involves some historical scrutiny of the essence of what evangelicalism is in the first place. And so that's what I want to turn to in the first part of this paper, to give some kind of historically grounded consideration to the very essence of the evangelical movement, so we actually know what we're talking about and can understand some of the key foundational reasons that I think exist inherently within the movement that lead to diversity and perhaps even polarization. So the first section then, an attempt at trying to define historically the evangelical movement. Defining evangelicalism is notoriously difficult. Most historical works begin with that kind of lament before turning in grateful relief to Professor David Bebbington's well-known definition of the movement. Evangelicals, he said, are Christians who are marked by four characteristics: the priorities of the cross, the Bible, activism, and conversionism. Without dismissing David's description of these core evangelical beliefs, my current favorite definition, I think one that might help us in this discussion, is actually provided by the American historian of the movement, Doug Sweeney, which is on the slide for you to have a look at. Sweeney says, evangelicalism is a movement of orthodox Protestant, it might be Protestantism, with an 18th century twist. I think this is a helpful way of understanding the complexities of the movement. And if we're to talk at all about polarization, this is the definition I'd come back to explain, and I will return to it at several points in the paper. Let me explain what this means, what I think it means, maybe what Sweeney thought it meant. First, theologically, Orthodox Protestantism. Well, evangelicalism is Protestant through and through. Not, of course, that all the 16th century Protestant reformers were by any means united on every single point, but to be simplistic about it, the five alones, the five solas of the Reformation, scripture alone, justification by grace alone, through faith alone, through Christ alone, to the glory of God alone, are key and remain key to Protestant evangelicalism. The 18th century evangelical revival was always a revival of Protestant orthodoxy. That was its core discovery. And that included a good deal of anti-Catholicism within the movement, not least here in Scotland. No coincidence that anti-Catholic politics and evangelical revival coincided somewhat around the Jacobite threat, for example, in the 1740s. The 18th century twist on this inherited Protestantism was, I think, threefold. Well, you could divide it in numerous ways. The first was the infusion into Protestant orthodoxy of the Lutheran Pietist movement, the continental European Pietist movement, a movement of continental European renewal that accepted Reformation doctrine, particularly Lutheran doctrine, and then said, very well, but what does it mean for you? You can know it in your head, but do you know Jesus in your heart? Spoke of the need for heart religion, a transformative experience of saving grace, a transformed lifestyle that would match doctrinal and confessional convictions. And it urged confidence and certainty in the knowledge of salvation, an inner conviction that Jesus Christ was mine, as well as a confession that he was the Son of God. And the entry point into this real and vital Christianity was described as the new birth, a decisive turning point from nominal to dynamic Christian faith. And so Pietism gave to evangelicalism a certain vocabulary for describing spiritual experience and gave an emphasis on the shared testimony of conversion, of the ongoing spiritual experience of evangelicals. As we'll see, that indeed has been one of the great forces for unity in the movement, the shared acknowledgement of parallel experiences between people and communities. And this appeal has overcome quite sharp doctrinal differences, but it has also, of course, injected a lasting and prevailing tension. Does personal experience matter more than confessional unity or theological certainty? Does dogma or drama matter more? The second twist, and in a way very interrelated to the Pietist movement, was the new emphasis in the 18th century on mission, related particularly to groups like the Moravians, evident in the field preaching of George Whitfield, John Wesley, as well as the foundation of multiple societies for the diffusion of the gospel, including the Glasgow Missionary Society and the Scottish Missionary Society, various Bible societies formed in Scotland in the early 19th century. Again, such zeal for diffusion of the gospel has historically led to many partnerships that have often been able to set aside differences of theology and churchmanship for evangelistic cooperation. Indeed, as we should see a little bit later in the paper, a shared commitment to evangelization has perhaps always been the most fruitful arena for evangelical ecumenicity. But when talking about this new emphasis on mission, we must also be aware we don't define that evangelical sense of the Great Commission too narrowly. Sometimes we divide between individual conversion or social regeneration. In fact, the great missionary impulse of the 18th century revival, the great goal summed up in that word revival, is not just personal revival, it's nothing short of revival of and revitalization of authentic New Testament Christianity. There has thus been, in this missionary impulse, a sense of what we might call primitivism, a desire to start again and recreate the church in real, dynamic, authentic terms. And yes, individuals' lives are part of that, the individual conversion. But evangelical missionary zeal has often gone hand in hand with a sense of maybe leaving behind the dead structures, the formal structures of the inherited church, and beginning again. And we'll see that time and time again, evangelical vitality in history has been accompanied by new churches, new wineskins. And of course, so obvious in a way it doesn't need to be stated, this is also one of the movement's great problems. To recover the pulsing heart of the New Testament evangel has always been the problem of defining what exactly is the pulsing heart of the New Testament evangel. What is really authentic Christianity? What is it not? That's, I think, why the issue of spiritual gifts are such a sore point within the movement, because they hit the movement's desire for authentic New Testament Christianity square on. Groups saying they are normative, the others saying no, they're not. It's right there in the heart of what it's meaning to be evangelical. Which moves us on to the third point and the third twist. Set this one up a little bit. And that's namely that evangelicalism, with a capital E, if you want, as it came about in the 18th century and continues to exist today, needs to be separated out somewhat from evangelicalism, with a lowercase e. The latter word, lowercase, I think we could define as a theological term referring to a desire present at numerous junctures in church history to recover gospel priorities. Thus, the 16th century Protestant reformers used it. The Franciscans used it, talking about the priority of evangelical poverty, where they found that the essence of the gospel, so they argued, was to live following the poor Christ. But they weren't strictly evangelicals in the common sense that we'd use the term today. Evangelicalism, with a capital E, refers to a self-conscious network of individuals and communities who have been willing, since the 18th century, in effect, to confirm that one another's version of evangelicalism, with a small e, is in fact the correct one, the authentic one. So it's not about poverty. No one really in the modern evangelical movement would agree the Franciscans should be called evangelical, maybe a few, but historically that has not been the case. Thus, evangelicalism, with a capital E, is a network of individuals and communities who interact, sharing stories, language, resources, worship, in order to basically self-authenticate each other's description of theological and spiritual reality. Thus, as George Marsden notes, and I think this will be up on the screen, another American historian of evangelicalism, that's not him. There we go. No, one more, maybe. One more. Maybe he's not there. There he is. Although we can clearly describe a conceptual unity to evangelicalism by pointing to shared doctrines and shared practices, there is, as he puts it, a more narrow, self-consciously evangelical, trans-denominational community with complicated infrastructures of institutions and persons which identify with evangelicalism. So there's a self-consciousness about the movement. Indeed, in this regard, some historians have used the terms to suggest that what happened in the 18th century was the invention of evangelicalism, the creation of evangelicalism. What do they mean by that? Well, clearly not the invention of some of the particular doctrines that we might, as evangelical theologians, associate with the movement. Clearly had 16th century Chalcedonian Nicene New Testament origins. What was invented was this self-conscious network of people talking with each other, feeling part of the same movement that we are analysing today. So that is the third twist that Sweeney points to. Evangelicals didn't just do new things, they were self-consciously aware of themselves doing new things. They were, to borrow a phrase from the historian Benedict Anderson, part of an imagined community, a community with a new alertness to the global reach of its priorities and its endeavors. Let me illustrate this a little bit, which might be a surprising point, with reference to the Cambus Lang revival, often dated as the beginning of evangelicalism in Scotland. What's significant about Cambus Lang is not that it's the first revival movement in Scotland, post-Reformation Scotland. There'd been others, at Stewarton in 1625, Kirk of Shotts in 1630, Obsdale in 1675. Each of these tended to be local renewal movements associated with the Presbyterian quarterly communion season. And the Cambus Lang revival in 1742 could have been another one of those in the Protestant Reformation renewal tradition, Presbyterian renewal tradition. What made it into something bigger, and why it's seen as linked to the broader evangelical revival, was that the participants imagined themselves being part of a movement that was constitutionally bound to events in Wales, England, New England, other parts of the United States. How did that happen? Well, first, a new factor was the presence of one of the first international evangelical celebrities, George Whitefield, who I think could go back. You can see preaching at Cumbers Lang. There he is. Gave a new joined-up sense to the movement. He'd visited Scotland many times during his life, but also toured America, where he was a celebrity, one of the biggest draws of the day. He employed Benjamin Franklin to publicize his activities, aware of the need to advertise and to promote. Second, at Cambus Lang, William McCulloch, minister of Cambus Lang, deliberately read from accounts of revival meetings happening in New England, particularly from, the next slide, Jonathan Edwards' faithful narrative of the surprising work of God. News about revival through the new accessibility of print media in the 18th century, indeed beginnings of globalization in a way, started creating a new movement. And the Scottish revivalist McCulloch and several other Scottish revivalists began writing their own narratives and indeed setting up newspapers, the Glasgow Weekly News, to disseminate news across the world. And then they also began a first, what they called, correspondent meeting, effectively, and a concert for prayer, effectively a world day of prayer, praying for future revival. They knew that they were part of something bigger, and they put in place the mechanisms that glued together this bigger movement, that made it not just a local renewal, but actually imagined that this was a transnational, global work of God. And those structures, publishing, meetings, festivals, and eventually, particularly from the 19th century, shared music, shared awareness of each other, becomes what turns a local phenomena into an international network that we call capital E evangelicalism. What does this mean in terms of the question before us? Well, here I speak tentatively as an English historian to a room of Scottish theologians. I'm not sure which one worries me most, being English or a historian. It means that we need to recognize that historically, evangelicalism is not a ready-made, concrete, coherent set of theological beliefs. It contains many concrete, coherent theological beliefs, but it understood historically rather than theologically. We also need to look and understand that its identity is as much as part of it being a social cultural movement, resting in its language, its texts, its dialogues, its sense of its own identity. And this means that non-theological categories, the type of music used, the type of festivals attended, the type of language deployed, and the type of organizations you belong to, in short, what we may dub the evangelical style or the evangelical subculture, can be as important in gluing people together and sometimes tearing people apart as pure doctrine or theology. And in some ways, I wonder whether our sense of polarization in the movement is in part an illusion created by the fact that there are these subcultural similarities under which lurk quite distinct theological differences. And we look at the similarities because they're the most obvious things to see. And then we dig a bit deeper and find the divergences, even the polarizations. And it worries us. And I wonder whether that worry is in part a failure to distinguish between theology as part of evangelical identity and what we might call social religious aspects of evangelical identity. And the second thing that it means in theory is that when we come to analyze this movement, why are evangelicals divided? As I've already hinted, we should not expect unity to be the normality and diversity the aberrant form. The movement is inherently a coalition. That was what was created in the 18th century. We know all about coalitions in our current climate, and sometimes how they don't always agree. Evangelicalism, the movement, since the 18th century, is inherently, by definition, a creative hypothesis rather than a solid, absolute, final institution. So while not ignoring the shared convictions and practices of the movement, and whilst by no means wishing to dismiss the fact that evangelical theologians spend most of their time trying to tease those out and talk about doctrine and theology and try and coming up with a normative model of what evangelical theology may look like. Historically, the evangelical movement exists and has as its very identity the fact that unity doesn't exist. If it did, then you wouldn't need the coalition. You wouldn't need the shared alliances. Evangelicalism is an imagined community of people who feel constitutionally alike, but who nevertheless paint many elements of their evangelical belief and practice with a small a with different colours. And we know what they've been throughout history and still sense those today. Arminian, Calvinist, Emergent, Charismatic, Pentecostals, Elders, Apostles, Open Theistic, Christus Victor, Penal Substitution, and so on. All of those making a claim to be authentic evangelical small e beliefs, and all of them participating in the evangelical capital E network. As a 19th century evangelical put it, negatively reviewing a proposal by some Scottish evangelicals that if we could only just get back to simple Bible-based church, we would avoid the need for multiple denominations. I've got this up on the screen for you to look at. Maybe it's a couple on. Yep, marked in red. He was not enthusiastic about this idea. Divine ideas are many-sided. In their many-sidedness, viewed in connection with their multiplicity and their consequent susceptibility of infinite, indefinite combinations, we find part of the reason why there are so many parties at present in the Christian church. And just as a side point, it's worth noting from Doug Sweeney again, that therefore evangelicals, capital E, are not the only ones to whom the term evangelical, small e, applies. Evangelicals are not the only ones to whom the term evangelical applies. In other words, evangelicals are of course not the only ones committed to recovering a New Testament gospel-centered Christianity. You see plenty of churches, including Catholics and Orthodox Christians, who seem to adhere to Jesus Christ and him crucified, yet are clearly not part of the evangelical movement as it's existed since the 18th century. And here in Scotland, we also see confessionally Protestant churches who also may be suspicious of participating in the evangelical movement. Presbyterian churches who clearly believe many of the same things on some key issues and yet don't feel comfortable participating in the evangelical network. United States, you see that perhaps also with the Southern Baptists. Their Baptist identity is more important than being part of an evangelical coalition, and they fear becoming part of that coalition will dilute some of the essentials, particularly perhaps in regards to, in both Scotland and the United States, to ecclesiology, Baptist identity or Presbyterian identity here in Scotland. They feel evangelicalism diminishes. Indeed, right at the beginning of the movement, we see that the associate presbytery under Ralph Erskine, who had originally invited George Whitfield to come and preach in Scotland in the early 1740s, in the end ended up as one of Whitfield's fiercest critics because Whitfield would not constrain his preaching merely to the associate presbytery, and in fact not to Presbyterian churches solely at all. Whitfield, I think we've got this up on the screen, said, "I come only as an occasional preacher to preach the simple gospel to all that are willing to hear me, or whatever denomination it is." And Ralph Erskine, obviously a believer in evangelical doctrines, with a small e, otherwise he wouldn't have invited Whitfield, and yet not willing to stake his ground on this new multinational, multi-denominational evangelical coalition, lamented, he says he can refuse no call to preach Christ, whoever gives it. Erskine, theologically probably evangelical, refused to participate in evangelicalism. Whitfield, of course, one of the architects of the evangelical capital E movement. So there's some theory, some reflections on some of the inherent reasons, some of the reasons why we perhaps might think that history teaches us things aren't quite as bad as maybe we think they are. History teaches us, as I say, to reassess the very question we're asking. But let's trace some of the more specific twists and turns of the movement, some of the ways in which evangelicalism has evolved, has developed, some of the tension lines that it has produced, whether it has tended towards evangelical ecumenicity, and whether, therefore, the tensions we feel that are real today are some kind of late, early 20th century crisis point in the movement, or whether, in fact, it's always had that tendency. So let's start in 1843. It was a good year. Significant year in Scottish church history. The event with which you're most familiar with, probably, the secession of over 450 evangelical ministers from the Church of Scotland to form the Free Church of Scotland. The foundation of the Free Church of Scotland, a national evangelical Presbyterian denomination, demonstrated how strong evangelicalism had grown in the late 18th century and early 19th century Kirk. spurred on by the growth of the evangelical movement in the Church of England that had arisen in the early 19th century Church of Scotland, a distinct evangelical party committed to the same doctrines first announced in the 18th century, heart religion, serious Christianity, Bible Christianity, commitment to mission and church extension. The Kirk version of evangelicalism was, because of their inheritance of the Church at the Presbyterian Reformation settlement, a national, holistic version of evangelical belief. They believed, like Wilberforce and the Anglicans did in England, that only true, serious, vital Christianity was going to save the nation from destruction, from judgment. And here we might conclude it all ought to have rested, largely spared the multiplication of dissenting denominations, such as the Methodists, that had sprung up in 17th and 18th century England. Were, of course, alternative splinter Presbyterian groups. The growth of Church of Scotland evangelicalism in the early 19th century ought to have offered a chance for a solidly national evangelical Church of Scotland, a comprehensive vision. That was certainly the vision of the leaders, Thomas Chalmers, with his very strong view of the national church. Thus, during the first 3 decades of the 19th century, evangelicals in the Church of Scotland had focused on strengthening local parish ministry, encouraging preaching, pastoral visitation, extending evangelistic outreach, particularly into growing urban centres, exemplified by Thomas Chalmers' experiment here in Glasgow, at making the parish an evangelical tool. And they had, of course, achieved considerable success in passing new legislation through the General Assembly in the 1830s that allowed the creation of new churches, new chapels, and gave congregations the right to call an evangelical minister without interference from the patron of the church. So in theory, what we might call the Chalmersarian model, the Thomas Chalmers model, should have worked as a force for evangelical unity, one national evangelical church. But the vision was curtailed by exactly the same forces that had caused it to come into existence in the first place. That is, the fact that evangelicalism was a monopoly-shattering phenomena. It had arisen in the 18th century, predicated on the idea of individual choice. It had disseminated itself using the language and techniques of the marketplace. It was bound to economic liberalization, to a free trade in Christianity. Now, that's often associated by historians most strongly with what happened in the United States, particularly after the Revolution. Nathan Hatch has talked about the democratization of American Christianity, and he's largely referring to evangelicalism there. But I think it's also clear that it was happening here. The growth of belief in real Christocentric evangelical Christianity, a strengthening sense of missionary zeal to urbanizing Scotland, and a discontent with the existing structures of the church to do justice to the urgent priorities of this gospel, tended towards, in the 19th century, plurality, starting again, breaking with the old, beginning with the new. Christendom, which is what arguably Scottish Presbyterianism, along with other European Reformation denominations, had largely perpetuated and sustained since the 16th century, was disintegrating. And evangelicalism, since the 1730s, was in part response to and in part cause of its ongoing demise. Evangelicalism stimulated the inherent Protestant tendency towards fragmentation and towards the creation of new religious groupings. This is how Methodism had evolved in England from an Anglican renewal movement into a separate denomination. The more evangelical, conversionist, activist Christianity was disseminated, the more disruptive of old territorial and denominational alliances it tended to be. And very soon, of course, Chalmers and the Kirk evangelicals realized this for themselves. When the moderates regained control of the General Assembly in 1838, Thomas Chalmers, a few years later, led the mass exodus of evangelicals from the Kirk, having so long stood for the vision of a one unity national evangelical church. Chalmers and his colleagues now found themselves religious voluntarists, participants somewhat unwillingly in a free market of Christianity in order to preserve evangelical priorities. And what's significant about 1843 and the disruption is that it wasn't actually that unique. The Scottish Church, because of evangelicalism, was witnessing a number of disruptions. Early evidence of this was the arrival of evangelical independency in Scotland. Next picture, associated with Lady Glenorchy, a wealthy evangelical patron who founded numerous interdenominational chapels in Scotland in the last three decades of the 18th century. And from 1798, the work of Robert and James Haldane, I think we've got Robert on the, yep, there he is, and the Society for Propagating the Gospel at Home, itinerant missionary agency to the Highlands, had been very much part of the interdenominational missionary impulse of evangelicalism. And the result was the springing up of numerous preaching tabernacles, independent evangelical churches in competition with the territorial Church of Scotland, the Presbyterians. And these congregations, along with the Haldanes themselves, soon split with the Church of Scotland, became the nucleus of 19th century evangelical congregationalism. And in 1812, the Congregational Union of Scotland became the key vehicle for what we might call a moderately evangelical Calvinistic congregationalism. Ralph Wardlaw, there's his bust up in the necropolis, was the leader of that movement. And in fact, of course, the irony is that Kirk evangelicals had also been creating chapels of ease, quasi-autonomous chapels associated with the Church of Scotland for the very same reason as the Haldanes and the Independents were creating them. Missionary priorities, a sense that the established church didn't serve its duties. A second stream of independency, the growth of Baptist churches, associated first with Archibald MacLean in 1768, who'd been influenced by George Whitfield, foundation of the Scotch Baptist Connection. And impelled forward by the work of the Baptist Missionary Society, a sense of mission and preaching of evangelical message. And then evangelicalism was also transforming the two older Presbyterian branch splinter groups of the evangelical movement. In 1823, the two branches of the Associate Synod combined to form the United Secession Church, and in 1847, this church combined with other 18th century Presbyterian splinter groups, the Relief Church, to form the United Presbyterian Church. The cause of the union shared evangelical missionary sentiments. So, although on the one hand evangelicalism there created unity, it also created another player in the evangelical marketplace, in an increasingly crowded evangelical marketplace, the market of voluntary organizations. And then in the 1830s and 1840s, further movements, further multiplications, additions. The Brethren movement began in the 1830s, picked up after the 1859 revival, did particularly well in the industrializing middle belt of Scotland, as well as in some rural fishing communities. And then in 1843 also, just a couple of days before the more famous Church of Scotland disruption, James Morrison founded what came to be called the Evangelical Union, walked out of the Secession Church and started preaching Arminian doctrine. He believed that missionary priority was best served by preaching unlimited atonement and free will. Another strand of primitivism in Scotland, the Churches of Christ, part of an American movement, again looking for a restatement of authentic Christianity, founded first in 1842, had around 49 churches by 1917. In 1842-3, there was also a disruption in the Episcopal Church about evangelical doctrines. David Drummond led his congregation of St. Thomas, Edinburgh, out of the Episcopal Church, and others followed him. So the point here is that by the mid-19th century, the kind of evangelical growth that had led to a strong Church of Scotland evangelical party under Chalmers had created the conditions for the luxuriant evangelical crops that sprouted throughout the rest of the 19th century. Scottish evangelicals had, willingly or otherwise, been forced to embrace a free trade in Christianity. And evangelicalism, therefore, we can see, is a very modern movement devoted to the marketplace. Its dissolution of confessionalism and local territorial church structures meant it inherently has a tendency to multiplication and divergence. It grows through its tendency to fracture old monopolies of religious privilege. Ironically, however, in the 19th century, these new groups were, as we've already noted, triggered by experience of shared participation in missionary agencies, in tract distribution societies, organizations like the Glasgow City Mission. So the sense that we need to do something new was actually created by a sense that we share something with others. We need to come out of our existing church structures and embody something new, but that doesn't mean it necessarily led to inherent diversity or polarization in the 19th century. In fact, several of these movements, the Brethren, the Churches of Christ, the Evangelical Union, were intended to reduce Christianity down to its barest, most simplest, and therefore most effective essentials in order to create a new vitality, a new vibrancy. So there was, in the 19th century, a combination, a multiplication of evangelical institutions that leads to a free market with all the associated divergences of belief that brings, that a confessing church like the Church of Scotland can contain by asking allegiance to certain creeds, or can try to contain by asking allegiances to certain creeds. That has been broken in the 19th century. But nevertheless, the spirit of the age, the fact that many of these come about by people sharing the same experiences of evangelical conversion and experience of participation in mission, actually leads to the late 19th century being quite a high point of evangelical ecumenicity. At the moment, therefore, when Scottish evangelicalism was more pluralistic than ever, we find Scottish evangelicals such as the Glasgow businessman John Henderson, United Secession minister Robert Barmer, Free Church moderator Robert Candlish, and the Congregationalist Ralph Wardlaw leading a campaign in the mid-1840s to establish a worldwide evangelical alliance. The eventual creation of this evangelical alliance stressed and even celebrated the precise tension between unity and diversity. We'll put this maybe the next couple. Yeah, that actually is the evangelical celebratory tea towel that is produced to celebrate the evangelical alliance. Had one of those today rather than the notepads, maybe. But I'll just go back one slide. Evangelical Alliance, which confessed to be of professing Christians of many denominations, all exercising the right of private judgment. There's the 19th century key. That's why there were so many evangelical institutions founded. Evangelicalism wanted to exercise the right of private judgment, hence the diversity in the 19th century. And yet, through common infirmity, differing amongst themselves, and so on, we join to express and promote Christian union. Not to create unity, but to confess it is the design of the assembling together. In fact, in the late 19th century, there is a kind of feeling that maybe denominational strife is ending. And this feeling is most associated with the movement that we call revivalism. When James Morrison walked out of the Secession Church and began formation of the Evangelical Union, he had been, as I say, started to preach Arminian doctrine. He felt that was the only way that the true evangelical missionary impulse could be sustained, the free gospel freely offered, just like John Wesley. And he'd been reading Charles Finney, who's next, maybe two slides on. Charles Finney, not the kind of man you want to meet down a dark alley. Charles Finney's lectures on revival. Finney had talked about the way we need to use methods to win people for Christ. He said a revival is not a miracle. It's purely the philosophic result of the right use of the constituted means. God's given us ways to create revival. We need to use them scientifically. He wasn't afraid to say that. Just as you would water a seed, you don't expect the seed to grow without you watering it. So you must nurture revival through all sorts of mechanisms. And revivalism was triumphant in late 19th century Scottish evangelicalism. In his theory, became widely accepted. Bursts of revival in Dundee and Kilsyth in 1839, but really bedded down in the 1859 to 1861 revival, spurred on many of those existing denominations, particularly the Brethren, for example, here in urban centres, to greater growth. And it was perfected in the visit of the Chicago shoe salesman turned preacher D.L. Moody in the 1870s. He left a trail of philanthropic and missionary organisations across major cities of Scotland. William Ross, revivalist-minded pastor of Cowcaddens Free Church, echoed Finney, "We may not be able to command wealth or friends, but as long as God is true, we can command a blessing." Sense that if you do it right, if you pour money and energy and resources into big-scale revivalistic activity, you can get results. And results they did get in late 19th century Scotland. A myriad of mission agencies, of philanthropic organizations, Children's Special Service Mission, later Scripps Union, for example, mission halls. We're standing in the grandchild of one of those enterprises, the Glasgow United Evangelistic Association, with the Bible Training Institute and the Tent Hall Mission Hall at its heart. Revivalism swept up these multiple evangelical institutions into a great deal of practical unity. "A sort of delightful spirit of harmony among the Brethren," wrote the UFC minister J.D. Robertson in 1907. all the ministers speak in the same way of the blessing that has come. Revival meetings were regularly held across multiple churches. Everyone was often involved in the locality. Of course, it didn't mean denominational differences ended or that there wasn't a certain degree of rivalry for converts, but participation in great revival activity was an occasion for unity. But underlying this shift towards revivalism was a dark side, and that was the increasing soft peddling of dogmatics, of theology, in late 19th century evangelicalism. The reason that such unity could exist, in part, was because late 19th century evangelicals resisted probing too deeply into the denominational and theological differences that might threaten the revivalist project. Thus, it was noted of a revival at Charlotte Chapel, of all places, in 1905, there was little preaching. And the Evangelical Union and other churches were kind of prescient in this regard. They wanted a minimalism, the Bible alone. We don't have much time for creeds, dogmatics. We want to get on and put in place a very pragmatic kind of revivalism, of the kind that Finney talked about. Revivalism that gets results. This they equated with authentic New Testament Christianity, a simple gospel, avowedly so. Yet this decline of dogma meant that revivalist ecumenicity hid and may even have irritated future evangelical divergence. This was because the decline of dogma in the 19th century was not limited to revivalist evangelicals. It was occurring throughout theological faculties of Europe and bringing into that theological temperament that we would today call theological liberalism. Desire to read the Bible as any other text, a new sense that religious beliefs grow and mature. The increasing focus on Christ, the human comforter, an ethical example, rather than the atoning sacrifice. Now, on the one hand, revivalist Christianity seemed a world away from the intellectual emphasis of liberal theology. D.L. Moody is reported to have quipped, "I don't see why you men are talking about two Isaiahs when half the people out there don't know there's one Isaiah here." However, by subduing the pursuit of dogmatic or confessional truth, late Victorian Scottish revivalism was an umbrella under which sheltered individuals who were being transformed by the new romantic fashions of the day, by exactly the kind of scholarship Moody was sceptical, and the common ground, anti-dogmatism. Revivalism, with its focus on feeling and warmth, allowed those who wanted to embrace higher critical biblical methodology or evolutionary social theory to do so unhindered, while still maintaining and proclaiming a personal piety, a love of Jesus. Here is that tension. Is it doctrine, the Reformation orthodoxy, or is it the twist, individual experience, that is the key? So we can see this, for example, in Alexander White. He's on the next slide. There's a few pictures of revivalism, very quickly. Yes, there we go. Keep going. There he is. White, minister of Free St. George's, Edinburgh, very strong supporter of D.L. Moody and the Revival Project, equally supporter of the right of a higher critical methodology in the academy. White, his biographer, reported, on the next slide, once spoke at a revival meeting and spoke on the hymn, "Just As I Am," with an eloquence, a pathos, and a homecoming power which made this address stand out in the memory of some who knew him. White was pietist, warm, emotional, able to speak about "just as I am," and yet probe his theological ideas. They may seem in many ways a world away from what would come to be seen as conservative evangelical belief. See this also in Henry Drummond, who I haven't got time to talk about, but another opponent of social evolution, and yet also a strong revivalist preacher who would lay it on the line for young men about how they needed to get right with Christ. Now, of course, revival could also be supported by non-liberal theologians, like Horatius Bonar, for example. And the shared glue, though, the point I want to make is that romanticism, which David Bevington would point out if he was standing here, romanticism is the shared glue. The broad Victorian temperament that prefers to feel rather than to think, prefers sense more than sensibility. The revivalist tradition represented more than evangelistic strategy. It was a venue for religious expressionism. That's what they talked about when they talked about getting the blessing. Accounts of revival were about people often lying on the floor, weeping for hours, sensing the presence of God. Words were at a discount, emotion was at a premium. And the ideas sweeping academic theology were also highly romantic, going back to the origins in the 18th century thinker Schleiermacher, arguing that it's more important to feel than to have dogma. Of course, evangelicalism, with its pietist roots, came into existence at the same time as theological liberalism, that true religion is about intuition and feeling rather than about dogma. And so that was the core bond that allows late 19th century evangelicalism to remain united, and in fact united with some people who in the 20th century will be seen to be its enemies, the liberal theological critics. And in fact, of course, such a happy coalition couldn't last. Broadly put, in the early decades of the 20th century, there emerged a distinct fracture line within the evangelical movement, here in Scotland as in elsewhere, between those who felt it was enough to be evangelical on the basis of warm heart devotion to Jesus Christ, Alexander White, Henry Drummond, and indeed some who were not participants in liberal theology as such, but who felt that was the essence of Christianity, and those who wanted a more robust statement of dogma of the Protestant orthodoxy. In the United States, that movement is called fundamentalism, that emerges in the early 20th century, wanting a more concrete affirmation. And the movement, in fact, arises because of a series of pamphlets. Got a cover page, couple on. Let's keep going. There we go. Called the Fundamentals, to which numerous Scottish evangelicals actually contribute in the early 1910 to 1915. James Orr, Thomas Whitelaw, T.W. Medhurst. The word fundamentalism has all sorts of resonances here, so let's call the movement in Scotland foundationalism rather than fundamentalism to avoid any misconceptions. Foundationalism, perhaps best represented by the Bible Training Institute and its principal, David McIntyre. Who actually is one of the few British evangelicals to maintain the doctrine of inerrancy as a way of guarding against higher critical biblical methodology. Evangelical foundationalism stresses the essential dogmas, the virgin birth, the historicity of Christ, of the necessity of the atonement. Evangelical foundationalism doesn't reject the evangelical activity that we've seen as being part of revivalism, and it still does maintain a strong interdenominational feel, leading most of all to perhaps the Billy Graham Crusades in 1955 at Kelvin Hall. But the longer-term legacy of this foundationalist movement was to force what we now call conservative evangelicals, those who didn't embrace higher critical methodologies, to see that allowing evangelicalism to be defined merely by piety was to allow the possibility that liberal theology could creep in. And so the return to doctrine and dogma was a reaction. The movement was helped by the broader neo-orthodoxy movement of the 1930s and perhaps sprang most of all from the universities. The Edinburgh Medical Missionary Society, for example, was at the forefront of articulating a need for a more intellectually satisfying definition and version of evangelicalism. Scottish participation in the InterVarsity Fellowship, founded in 1928, was another sign of this, and need for a more intellectually credible faith, version of evangelical faith in the universities, led by people like Daniel Lamont, Chair of Apologetics at New College Edinburgh, and Duncan Blair, the Regius Professor of Anatomy at Glasgow University, desiring more intellectual rigour, dissatisfied with the old revivalist sentiment and emotion. And the revivalist culture slowly died in 20th century evangelicalism, played out particularly, perhaps most famously, in the Church of Scotland, associated with the next man, probably. No, go on from there. Yep. With William Steele, who at Gilcomston South symbolically ended the Saturday night revival youth rallies, a product of the old, more flashy, sentimental revivalist culture, and introduced prayer and systematic expository preaching. This is what he said very revealingly. After 18 months of aggressive evangelism, revivalist style, during which we draw large crowds, mostly of evangelistic folk, it means I think they're revivalist folk from every sort of church, assembly, mission, and sect, word sect, slightly pejorative. I turned the word of God upon the Christians for the sake of the large nursery of babes. From one Sunday to another, you could not see that mission crowd, the dust. And still stood at the heart of a new conservative, foundationalist, moderate Calvinist party in the Church of Scotland, including George Philip, Eric Alexander, George Duncan, supported by the Creed Fraternal and helped by a broader rediscovery of similar movements across the United Kingdom, the Martin Lloyd-Jones Foundation of the Banner of Truth Trust, and so on. It's important to note, of course, that some of this happened partly because mid-20th century people generally in Britain were a bit suspicious of late Victorian sentiment and emotionalism, a much more sober attitude to the world, product of two world wars. So, if revivalism actually slowly died, the Tent Hall, for example, closing down, the Great Mission Hall was closing, not much that looks like that today, and in a way, foundationalism and a restatement of dogma triumphs over revivalism, why do we still have any tensions? Well, the result of two things, who we might call the offspring, the children of the late 19th century romantic renewal movement. The first is that there remained many evangelicals who felt that a certain amount of doctrinal fluidity and a consideration of liberal theological trends was admissible as long as one maintained piety and confession of Jesus as the linchpin of faith, that it was okay to continue exploring the liberal theological agenda. The continuing United Free Church of Scotland was perhaps marked by this spirit most of all institutionally. But after 1960 in particular, the mature thoughts of theological liberalism started to be discussed again amongst evangelicals of all types across Scotland. You can read more about some of those discussions in Dr. Jeffrey Grogan's book, where he outlines some of those tensions and challenges that are really, in essence, the result of evangelicals considering what we are broadly and simplistically putting the fruits of theological revisionism, that's a better word than liberalism, that stretch back to the 19th century. And some of these doctrines received greater purchase after 1960s because they resonated with that other child of late Victorian Romanticism, a child that looked quite a bit like its revivalist parent, but had some subtle differences, what we might call renewalism, most associated with what we call the charismatic movement since the 1960s. The renewalists were heirs to the late 19th century focus on personal piety and warmth, who shared the late Victorian sense that there was more to true Christianity than cerebral confession or dogmatic assertions. There was no simple equation between the two, between more liberal theology and charismatic, but both did share the sense that it's important to let the Spirit shine new light into old confessions, old doctrines. The origins of the modern charismatic movement, then, are firmly rooted in the late 19th century renewal movement, and particularly in an element of revivalism of the late 19th century that we can call holiness or the second blessing, the belief that after conversion there is a second decisive, more powerful almost experience that a believer can expect, associated particularly with the Keswick Convention, which had a presence here, met from 1892, a Scottish Keswick at Bridge of Allen. To read accounts of late 19th century revivalism, this shared glue, this ecumenical glue in a way, and often you find it's not so much conversion that's going on, but consecration, dedication, higher spiritual experience, people who are already Christians getting some new blessing, some new portion of God. Well, as the more foundationalist, dogmatic element of evangelicalism asserted itself more in the early 20th century, as I said, the heavy experimentalism or experientialism of conservative evangelicals diminished amongst many, including people at Keswick, for example. So we have Graham Scroggie, minister of Charlotte Chapel, talking about the second blessing not being a blessing, which it is right for the believer to seek. But second blessing teaching, this whole idea of a post-conversion experience became institutionalized, firstly in a number of relatively small movements in Scotland, but significant ones, like the Salvation Army, the Church of the Nazarene, the Faith Mission, that maintained that the second blessing was a moment of dedication, consecration. And then a larger set of churches in post-20th century that we call Pentecostals, who maintain that the second blessing was endowment with power, with the apostolic gifts of prophecy, of healing, and of speaking in tongues. Early Pentecostals in Kilsyth, for example, in 1908. George Jeffreys comes and leads big campaigns in Glasgow in the 1910s, 1920s. But then, most of all, in the post-1960s, charismatic movement that embraces the idea, perhaps not of a strict second blessing, but of the idea that there is a continual growth, a continual expectation for more love, more power, more of you in my life. Quote the song. I wasn't looking at anyone in particular when I said that. Need some historians to write more about the charismatic movement in Scotland. First manifest probably around 1961, New College, Edinburgh. Strange new sect in the Scottish Kirk, reported the Glasgow Sunday Mail. Influenced particularly Baptist congregations to begin with. As I said, it involved not only a strict theory of a second blessing, but a new informality, a new sense of spontaneity, of creativity, that affected numerous denominations. And like the renewalism of the late 19th century that gave it birth, and from which it derived its origins, it was a force for unity, with the sense of shared spiritual experience, creating ecumenical relations, particularly participations in festivals such as Spring Harvest, for example, in the early 1990s, held at Ayr for several years, or the March for Jesus. And particularly, as had always been the case, shared hymns and songs and music provided one of the key constituted bonds of union that charismatics offered evangelicals, so that actually even many non-charismatic churches would end up asking for the Spirit to blaze and set our hearts on fire by the late 1980s, early 1990s, even though the preacher would say no such thing in the sermon. So much like the renewal movement, the charismatic movement of the 1960s shared piety, shared the 18th century twist on Reformation orthodoxy, and said, yes, experience here of ongoing renewal and blessing of the Spirit and empowerment of the Spirit is a source of unity, and we can overlook some of the distinctions. But of course, to some of those foundationalists, who charismatics perhaps now wrongly saw as the old traditionalists, when in fact they had themselves been recreators, 1930s, 40s, 50s innovators, to those foundationalists, Stills in the Church of Scotland, some of the other Presbyterian denominations, this looked all too much like the exact kind of ideas that they reacted against and had got rid of. It looked too much like the Arminian holiness tradition of the late 19th century, the kind of tradition that opened up the way to liberal theology, theological revisionism. And of course, some charismatic churches did move and start, there was convergence between charismatic experimentalism and experimentalism with theology, and broadly the kind of emerging church, which is a label to cover a multitude of expressions of late 20th century, early 21st century experimentation. It does see some link between the phenomena that causes both charismatic renewal and the phenomena that encourages some revision of some expressions and some doctrines of church, although it's a very complex relationship. And in the late 1990s, Scotland has witnessed a new burst of church planting. Like where we began the story, the urban centres of lowland Scotland are particularly fertile ground. Just like the Brethren or the Evangelical Union, many of these new churches, put up probably the last slide. Here's some just from West End of Glasgow, claim to be representing authentic, primitive, Bible, apostolic Christianity, an attempt at starting again, an attempt at making Christianity real and authentic for the new generation. And these new churches are not bound necessarily by any theological unity, but except by the desire to reform, to begin again. That's what binds them, and just as in some ways it did in the 19th century, the belief that to be true to the mission of the church, the mission of the gospel, and to the essence of what it means to be a true Christian, an evangelical Christian, it's important to pour the wine into new wineskins. And because some of these have quite complex international networks, often they perhaps don't appear initially that they want to be players within the older evangelical coalition. Time will tell whether these are eventually assimilated in. History suggests that they will be to a large degree. I skipped over a fair bit in the end there, but let me conclude and have some questions and discussions. Evangelicalism is prone to divergence and even polarization because it is, by very definition, a coalition movement. It's not a coalition on the pathway to greater unity. Rather, it's the phenomena of the voluntaristic, post-Enlightenment free market in religious belief, which means its very essence is pluriformity. Uniformity, in a word, would kill it dead. Its point is that it's diverse, something the founders of the Evangelical Alliance, for example, recognized. Evangelicalism in Scotland since the early 19th century has always created multiple non-totalizing communities. And points we haven't mentioned and that ought to be mentioned if there was more research on them, they're also marked, of course, by many other non-theological factors, divergent socioeconomic bases, locality, said a bit about ecclesiology, and of course, one important thing, and if you stay around for a couple of days, you'll see on Thursday, also ethnicity. One of the divergences in British evangelicalism as a whole is the failure of white and black evangelicals, particularly black evangelicals being represented by Pentecostal groups and holiness groups, to assimilate. And there's a big conference happening partly here on Thursday, where numerous Glasgow black holiness and Pentecostal pastors will be talking. That, of course, is the divergence only just being discovered and analysed by sociologists, historians, and theologians, and needs a lot more work and thought done to it. So, you know, there's a tendency we shouldn't just look at the big theological trends in plotting divergence. By the same token, many of these communities that came into being in this religious free market have come into being precisely because they have expressed a similar discontent with the existing state of the church, with the spiritual temperature of the nation, with individual piety. In particular, as I've suggested, the drive for New Testament primitivism has pulsed through each generation of Scottish evangelicals, particularly since the 1840s, but going right back to the revival of the 1730s and 40s. Evangelicalism has possessed a desire for simple fellowship, unity in essential priorities, that's been shaped by its fierce commitment to missiological relevance. And in the late 19th century, this allowed for considerable ecumenical unity based around the priorities of simple, direct mass preaching and revival. That's its greatest strength and also its greatest weakness. Because, as we saw in the 19th century, in the end, fracture lines eventually emerge. And I think those fracture lines, in essence, can be traced back to what Sweeney identified in the first place. The greatest tension point in the movement is the marriage of the two parents that gave it birth. The Reformation protest of the 16th century and the Enlightenment protest, the Reformation protest at Catholic hegemony in favor of Augustinian doctrines of grace in the 16th century, and the Enlightenment protest against the totalizing confessionalism of Christendom in favor of personal authenticity, personally chosen experience in the 18th century. As I suggested, sometimes I wonder if we as observers of the movement are shocked by polarization because we sometimes fail to note the evangelical style, the evangelical coalition, sometimes makes communities look more alike than actually we should really expect them to be, all things being equal. Would it be wrong to conclude there's just one polarization in Scottish evangelicalism? In reality, there's a complex network of overlapping communities. Derek Tidball likened evangelicalism to a Rubik's Cube, which I think I looked up and had something like 43 million or maybe billion possible configurations. Sometimes uniting, sometimes divergent, each tracing shared roots in particular theological trends, particular moments of history, particular ecclesiologies, and sharing or resisting updates and reappraisals of both theology and style. And this means evangelicalism will always go on asking the questions we're asking today. What makes an evangelical? Why are we divided? And is the movement going to the dogs? Chewing over that vexed question, Lord Shaftesbury, late 19th century evangelical, final slide, commented, "I know what constitutes an evangelical in former times. I have no clear notion what constitutes one now." Perhaps we might suggest mischievously that the evangelical identity crisis is in fact one of the most enduring and uniform hallmarks of evangelical identity. And it's perhaps only when the question stops being asked that we ought to start worrying. Thanks.
who wish to do so, please identify who you are. All of us, I think, so that we don't all know one another. So now, it's feedback time.
David Reimer, thank you so much, Martin. That was an illuminating story, well told, and I appreciate it greatly. Start with the 18th century. I just wonder if you have any brief reflections on the sort of Puritan heritage in Scotland and how that contributes to the trends you're talking about. And I think of somebody like Samuel Rutherford, for instance, who was able to write something like Lex Rex, or was it Rex Lex, I can never remember, and yet wrote those letters, which are so touching and emotive. I mean, is there a strand there that feeds into this picture as well?
You've hit upon one of the controversial questions that numerous people took David Bevington to task to recently and asked if evangelicalism was created in the 18th century, as David suggests, largely because of the new doctrines of he says, of assurance, of the Enlightenment features and so on. What about the Puritans? Are you dismissing the Puritan legacy? And numerous people in the book called Continuities in Evangelical History, if you're interested, say, well, yes, he is dismissing the Puritan legacy. Clearly, Puritanism is an experimental, if you want, experiential movement of what we can call heartfelt Christianity. I think that evangelicalism allows the possibility of greater flexibility in doctrine and expression than the Puritan movement allowed, so that although obviously a kind of overlapping points, in some cases there's not much to see between a Calvinist evangelical and a Puritan. The evangelical movement also embraces people who are very different to Puritans, who have this much more minimalist, you know, in the revivalist tradition in the 19th century. And even Whitfield, who are less concerned with precision, perhaps, than the Puritan movement is. But clearly, there's another question, did Scotland have Puritans if they were people wanting to reform the Church of England, if that's what a Puritan is, that's another question. Clearly there is a link. The early evangelicals read Puritans and continue to read them and are fired up by them. And, of course, 20th century evangelicals, particularly in that foundationalist movement, reprint Puritans as a way of opposing the revivalist, renewalist strand of the movement and saying, actually, this is the kind of heartfelt Christianity we want, one that holds together head and heart and doesn't try and divorce them. So there is an ongoing resonance of the Puritans. I do think that that's where the idea of distinguishing between evangelical doctrine and evangelical coalition is helpful in a way, in that the 18th century sees the birth of a new movement. Doesn't necessarily always see the birth of new theology, because there's lots of continuities, although clearly there is also a tendency towards Arminianism, which increases, if not theoretical, then at least kind of a pragmatic Arminianism by the late 19th century. Although, of course, some Puritans were also Arminianist, a minority in the 16th century as well. So.
Established denomination, if you like, and often get frustrated, for example, with the lack of mission, and step up to be involved in evangelism, and eventually find themselves forming their own group. And this does seem to happen time and time again. I think someone like John Wesley is quite a good example of that, someone who it seems wasn't always welcome in established churches and stepped out, and then, of course, formed the Methodist movement. And that, some of the people who have looked at this say that even in one generation of a new movement, that becoming of an institution seems to very often happen. I don't know if you have any views on why you think that so often seems to take place. You mentioned several new churches in Glasgow as if possibly a similar thing is linked to what I've just said.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a clear pattern of what evangelicalism is multiplication and diversity over from the 18th century onwards. I think we're seeing a big burst of that now, parallel to a similar big burst around the turn of the 20th century that brought into existence Salvation Army, Faith Mission, and the Pentecostal denominations, and an earlier burst around 1830 to 1860 that brought in to existence Circle of Christ, Faith Mission, and the Brethren, and so on. I mean, it happens for complex reasons of the modern world in some ways, because of notions of choice, as I said, of the free market, of the decline of what we call Christendom and the notion of totalitizing entities that bind us together. The voluntary society is ironically a creation of evangelicals with the anti-slavery campaign, and the idea of freely associating individuals who gather together for a common end rather than gather together because they live in the same place is the product of complex economic social changes in the West. So, you know, at root, that's why it happens and why it's allowed to happen, because in a way the government has to stop penalties for people doing that. You can no longer be thrown in prison for not going to your local church. You know, that's part of the story as well. That's why the evangelical revival works, because it's permitted to work. But I do think, as I said at the beginning, that the drive for primitivism is a strong one within evangelicalism. That produces... And that's, I guess, what I was reflecting on, is that it produces both diversity. That doesn't alone explain theological divergence, because often, as I said, the diversity comes from the same place. So in the 19th century, it comes from a feeling that we want to start again and maybe downplay Calvinism, downplay dogma, and play free will, and put on a big show, and everyone ends up cooperating in some way. And kind of looks similar. I think it does explain divergence of identity in that sense. Yeah, that's probably as good as I've got. I'm happy to receive other viewpoints. It's just a free marketplace here as well. So. This is not the definitive explanation, just a set of thoughts on some aspect of evangelical identity, so I'd like to hear your views as well.
The last 50 years we've seen a growth of secularism as almost a belief. How do you think that's going to affect the evangelical story that goes on?
I think that evangelicals have always known and been aware of what they called in the 18th century infidelity, or atheism, or what we might call secularism, and that is in a way one of its prevailing motivations right from the beginning. That's been what evangelicals have felt needs to be combated. So although I wouldn't want to say it won't have any effect, it won't have any different effect, of course it's played out in different ways in the modern world, I'm not sure it's as entirely new as we sometimes imagine, because that's really what, you know, that's kind of quote which I didn't say, that Church of Scotland evangelicals in the 18th century talked about Robert Walker said, the power of godliness has declined and languished, a cold formality has at length given way, the open profession of infidelity itself. And his answer was, we need an evangelical revival in the church. So I think there's always been a sense of the secular. And of course, evangelicalism in a way allows for that to be the case because of its emphasis on choice. You can not believe. I mean, that's the unwritten get-at clause of an evangelical gospel presentation, is you can say no. So... in a sense, evangelicalism is the product of a society, of a culture that allows actually quite vibrant religious belief on the one hand, freely chosen, and actually quite sometimes militant expressions of secular belief on the other. So I'm not sure there's anything necessarily for evangelicals to fear quite as much as they, as we sometimes do by secularism. If we maintain that we quite like the idea of evangelical free choice, if we want to re-establish Christendom, then that might be a different matter. But if we like what evangelicalism says about freely choosing Christ, then I think in some ways we have to live with the flip side, the unwritten rule of that. And I think that's always been the case since the 18th century. Yeah.
Jason Curtis, thank you, Martin, for your paper. I noticed on the, just a quick glance at the resolution for the Evangelical Alliance, that the grounding of that activity was a doctrinal one, at least in that paragraph that you showed us, which was, we're not just longing for a unity of the church that's artificial, but we're confessing it. I think that was the language.
Yeah.
That this is the church, the nature of the church, which is creedal, which is doctrinal. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even with a sense of diversity, and maybe that is endemic to evangelicalism, there was still a strong sense, at least among these folks, that there is a unity and that there is a divine unity to be acknowledged in the church. I'm wondering if you think that notion amongst evangelicals in the present day is still here, perhaps is lost. Maybe just comment on, you know, give our current situation as compared with early 19th century when that was kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think there obviously is a injection in the late 19th century of alternative ways of approaching traditional Christian beliefs that are grounded in higher critical methods, as I said, the liberal theological agenda that diversifies the range of confessions one might want to make as a Christian, and one feels that is legitimate to make as a Christian. So that in the Evangelical Alliance case, certainly in a British sense, the alternative ways of talking about the Bible or the atonement or the divinity of Christ, I mean, have been raised by Unitarians and so on. They're not unknown, but they're not really. There is a greater sense that you can stake Christian unity on Orthodox Christian belief in that sense, and the late 19th century review of those that continues to play out in theology faculties throughout the world today and is explored by some evangelicals, sometimes in the name of updating belief, but sometimes in the name of biblical fidelity itself, such as people who would say they're open theist on the basis exactly of what Evangelical Alliance said, fidelity to the Bible, does mean there's a more complicated set of ideas today than perhaps the Evangelical Alliance in the 1840s had on its radar as being possibilities for statements of belief. And certainly, you know, I'd spent quite a lot of time, in a way, saying it's more than doctrine. I mean, the point I didn't make quite as much of was that it is Protestant belief. I mean, there is an essential sense of what orthodoxy is. I mean, Mark Smith says before you get to what evangelicals believe, there's a kind of precognitive idea of what evangelicals have, which is that true belief can be had and its holding is not unimportant, which is a series of double negatives. But there is a kind of, before saying what the belief is, evangelicals are united by a very non-liberal, non-pluralistic idea that there is a true belief, the New Testament version of Christianity, however approached and defined, and that it's important to get it right. And I guess that's probably what I see on the Evangelical Alliance, on that statement that although we differ about what that is, we do believe that we can get there and that we ought to search for it and we ought to strive for it. And I guess that's probably an evangelical commitment to doctrine. And of course, yes, I mean, it's Protestant, and evangelicals are, even if they're unaware of it sometimes, bound by the historic confessions and creeds of the church because they tend to look back towards a primitive apostolic belief. That grounding in authority and tradition, but they weren't talking those terms, is important. So, yes, there is a doctrinal heart. I wouldn't want to minimize that by kind of some of the corrective stuff that I've given. I'm not sure that fully answers what you have.
Do you think we're seeing an emergence of evangelical Roman Catholicism and evangelical Orthodoxy? I mean, the Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
Not your way of using
it. Yeah. Well, I think that goes back to that capital E or small e question. Yes, I mean, well, and yeah, I think clearly Roman Catholics, and probably more Catholics than Orthodox, to be honest, have adopted some of the style and piety of the evangelical movement. So using instruments in worship, perhaps singing some of the songs of the charismatic renewal. There has been a charismatic movement in Catholicism in the 20th century, adopting the Alpha Course. So they are plugging into that network in some senses. And of course, there is also a small evangelical movement within Catholicism as well. And there's greater ecumenical dialogue between evangelicals and Catholics now than there ever has been. I think, I mean, any talk about evangelical Catholicism has to decide, are you talking about Catholics who plug into the evangelical network by taking on the Alpha Course, or are we talking about Catholics that we like, as it were, or that we can sympathize with, who would state their belief in similar terms to us? And if similar beliefs to us, what do we mean? Is it the twist? They have a relationship with Jesus in their heart, they know him, or is it the doctrine, salvation by grace through faith alone, scripture alone? I think probably if the former, then if the latter rather, then despite ecumenical strides between Protestants and Catholics, there still is quite a lot of divergence. As long as evangelicalism remains committed to Protestantism, then it's obviously slightly oxymoronic to say you can have a evangelical Catholicism, because evangelicalism means commitment to Protestant Christianity. If, however, you mean personal piety and perhaps even charismatic experience, then I think probably you can talk about that. I don't know as much about Orthodoxy as Catholicism, but there's probably a similar theoretical set of things to consider with that as well.